You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It was bittersweet of a night for fans of the U.S. men's national team. On one hand, Timo Weah celebrated his birthday and Christian Pulisic got on the score sheet at Stamford Bridge. While elsewhere, Weston McKennie hobbled off the field against Villarreal. I'm Heath Pierce and I'm joined by Jimmy and Jonathan to break down Tuesday's Champions League action. Que Golazo begins right now. Now, everyone, if you're watching this live on YouTube, like the video. Go on. It only takes a second and it costs you nothing. More likes means we get Que Golazo in front of more eyeballs and it helps us grow. And that's what we want to do so we can make this community bigger and better. And some of you are listening to this in podcast form. That's nice of you. You know, it's even nicer, as we usually say, subscribing to the Que Golazo podcast wherever you get your podcasts and take a minute to leave a glowing rating and a review. Life hack, you can do that right now while you listen to this. What is going on, Jimmy Conrad, JJ? Appreciate you guys joining me. JJ, we'll start with you. I mean, what's your takeaways from this Chelsea-Lille match? Obviously, the man who is our specialist around the French league. We didn't get to see, on a selfish level, our Timo Weah. We got to see him have a birthday, and it was celebrated, as I mentioned in the intro, with a goal from Christian Pulisic. What was your what were your main takeaways, I guess, from this match?
I hope you guys can subtitle my French right now. That's my main take.
That was so French. That was so French.
No, really. It's, I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think we should give Lille credit because they didn't collapse when I thought they would early on conceding that goal. I really feared the worst for them. They kept it respectable, which was my pre-match prediction. But also at the same time, I mean, it was a pretty tedious watch. You kind of knew that Lille were basically fighting to keep it one goal in it going back to France. You know, they now really face an uphill task being two goals down. I mean, obviously anything can happen in 90 minutes, especially when you play at home in the second leg of a game like this. But really, do I see Lille being able to turn the tide against this Chelsea side? No, I don't. I didn't see enough from them tonight. I will add that I think that the big positive for them, the really big positive for them, was Renato Sanchez. I thought he was fantastic. And I think if you get Jonathan David into a game like that, anything can happen. But they didn't. They weren't able to do enough. You know, Bamba was hustling as best he could up top. You know, just like Timo Weah was saying before the game in our interview with him, it hasn't clicked for Lille all season, didn't click for them here, you know, and you just kind of hope for them that it will do between now and the end of the season so they can at least get themselves back into Europe via the league.
Okay, let's focus on Lille really quick here, JJ, because I have some questions for you. Timo Weah was expected to start, doesn't start, and then doesn't even come off the bench. So he's got a couple older guys, Burak Yılmaz that comes off the bench, and then you got hate him or love him, Ben
timeless,
Arfa.
Timeless Ben Arfa and Burak Yılmaz.
Like, well, it's not like Onana was out there lighting it up. You know, you could have put Renato Sanchez into the middle and brought on Weah, maybe give you a little bit more something out wide. Are you surprised that Weah didn't get to play at all?
I mean, I'm surprised he didn't get to play at all. I did think that he'd come on. You know, I thought they could have used his energy and definitely needed more impetus in attack. Was I surprised that he didn't start? No, not so much. You know, I think Gorvenek was always going to try to be pragmatic. I mean, it's kind of a battle of who's going to be most pragmatic out of Gorvenek and Tuchel on these kind of nights. Obviously, Tuchel won that battle. But, you know, I think you really start to see the limitations of this Lille side now. And I'd actually be quite worried about the future for them when you look. You know, it's not just the attackers. It's not just Yılmaz. You know, it's not just Ben Arfa coming off the bench who are like sort of in their mid-30s. You've got Jose Fonch at the back, you know, pushing 40. You got Benjamin André. He's also into his 30s in the midfield. This is an aging team, you know, and it's a team that doesn't really have any ability to reinvent itself either, given the project at Lille. They've just been smacked with some punishment by the Court of Arbitration for Sport regarding Rafa Leão as well. So, you know, I don't understand why there was absolutely zero involvement of Weah in this kind of game, because they're going to need him going forward. You know, and if they don't, you know, consider him to sort of be a part of the project moving forward. I don't know, maybe they feel he's been too injury prone since arriving, mm-hmm. You know, not consistent enough. They're going to need to move him on and try to get a good transfer fee for him. And you're not going to be able to build his value up if you're not actually playing him. And I thought that it was a bit of a harsh decision by Govanek to not go for him, especially when you're bringing off the likes of Jonathan David in the last 10 minutes. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Jimmy, let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, as Timo Weah said, they haven't clicked all seasons, but here they are in the knockout rounds of the Champions League and really two goals back, which I think is too large of a gap to cover if you looked at them today. And I agree with you, JJ. Renato Sanches was unbelievable. He looked at a pace and an emphasis to go forward that I haven't seen in a while, especially when he's pulled out wide. But Jimmy, do you think that they're overperforming and that's what's gotten them here? Because it seems like you have to click on some level to reach the knockout rounds of the Champions League. And obviously their form in the league is very different than being in the knockout rounds of the Champions League. But I mean, what is it that they're missing? When you look at the tools on paper, it seems like they at least have some strengths that they should be. It seems like they're underperforming in the league and maybe performing at expectations in the Champions League when you look at the team that they have.
I don't know. If you take into context what's happened to them over the last year, obviously they were somewhat the surprise winners of Liga. I would say definitely surprise winners of Liga last season. And then their manager takes off and he's gone. He leaves to go to Nice. He's actually done quite well with Nice this particular season. So you lose that, and you lose that influence and anything you were trying to build, the culture, the environment, whatever it may be. And then on top of that, because you're so successful and because you have some talented players, people want to come buy your players. So then they lose Mike Mignon, their goalkeeper, to AC Milan. Sumari goes to Leicester City. Ikone goes to Fiorentina, whether that's over the summer or during the January transfer window. Now you're starting to get plucked. And then you add injuries on top of that. And then you have a new manager who's got his own style. And it just makes sense to me why they're currently 11th in the league table for them in France.
But they're on the same amount of losses as Strasbourg and Nice. I mean, you're talking about what looks like, and I would love your take, JJ, on this as well, when Jimmy wraps this thought up. It's just like, is it a game of moments for them? Is it moments that are costing them? Because you look on paper, they're 11th, but their seven losses is the same as Nice, and it's the same as Strasbourg, and it's the draws to the...
I just think there's a lack of consistency there, and it's going to be tough, especially now if you have Jonathan David, who's now going to try to be on display, right? Renato Sanches probably thinking we're going to move in the summer. And then you got Sven Botman, who also like, I'm probably going to move in the summer as well. So you got three guys that are in the spine of your team that are some of your younger players, to JJ's point, that's not helping the team if those players move. So how can you ever really build anything? They might make some coin off of these players, but I don't know if that's going to help them actually be competitive moving forward. I'd be kind of frustrated if I was a Lille fan at the moment.
Is it a full overhaul, JJ? Is it a full overhaul? I mean, obviously, like Jimmy mentioned, they're going to sell 3-4 players that they can make some bank on. And then you said there's obviously the players that are up there in age that they're going to have to make changes and or move on as well. I mean, are we looking at what seems like the end of a very short era of success at Lille?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, at the end of the day, Lille absolutely need some money this summer. They're going to have to move players on, especially if they now are going to have to consider those extra millions for Rafael Leao as well. It's not an ideal situation. I think that Lille made the best of it, managed to get the title win over the line in Ligue 1, which was huge. But the players expected a fire sale last summer. It didn't materialize. Renato Sanches could quite easily have been playing for another club tonight. The fact that he was even there for Lille, was quite fortuitous given that he picked up an injury at the wrong time. He was wanted again in January. I know clubs in the Premier League, like Wolverhampton Wanderers, for example, are keeping a keen eye on what's going on with him. A lot of guys are going to move on this summer. And I fear for Lille that the only guys who are really going to stick around are those older ones who aren't really going to add that much in the future. I mean, obviously, Lille have fantastic facilities. They're an established Ligue 1 club, and they're not actually that far away from the European places. One of the great things about Ligue 1 is that, the table can change, in the matter of sort of two games. If a team strings together two victories, suddenly they're moving up the places. And if you lose a couple in a row, you're dropping down quite substantially. I think that Lille can still close the gap on Europe. I don't think that they'll qualify for the Champions League, but I do think they can still salvage Europa League. And that for me would be a positive. I think there's always going to be some, sort of step down in consistency and motivation when you've won a league title, and suddenly, you've got that elation that comes with it. And like Jimmy said, you've got a number of key characters moving on. Mignon, Galtier, it was clear that they were moving on within 48 hours after the title was sewn up. So you know, I think naturally, you know, a lot of people's heads have been in different places so far this season, which probably accounts for, you know, what Weah was saying. And also I noticed there was a comment from Jackie D about why Weah plays so much better for the US men's national team than he does for Lille. And he said something really interesting in that interview that I was doing with him, where he said, basically feels in his happy place where he can sort of do anything, you know, do a million step overs or something like that, I think he mentioned. You know, he basically just feels more in his own skin when he's with the US men's national team than he does with Lille. And I felt that was quite telling about the situation in general.
I will say that I've been highly critical of those useless stepovers that he's done at times on the national team, but I'm glad he feels free when he's doing them. And for anybody that's watching this right now, where do you want to see Timo Weah next? We obviously saw Conrad De La Fuente come in. That also hasn't come to fruition. Where do we want to see these players, but Timo Weah in specific, where do you think the right club is for him next? And also make sure that you like and comment on these videos, and then subscribe if you haven't already. We want to keep you guys part of this community and growing this community. So Jimmy, let me ask you this. Let's shift back to Chelsea, since you wore the Chelsea shirt today. Your fourth or maybe fifth favorite team in the Premier League. Lukaku dropped. I mean, just what kind of statement do you think that is? Do you think it's a rotation, or is this a statement that's being made? And then on top of that, you actually saw a performance come together where Kai Havertz actually did an okay job. And I know this is the carousel of players they're putting into that position to just sort of fill that void. But clearly Lukaku hasn't done the job. I mean, what do you take away from the lineup that they put out there and the formation that they put out with Pulisic and Ziyech underneath?
Well, I'm curious to see what Tuchel's comments are about it after the game, just to see if we can unpack it and see if there's anything in between the lines of what he's saying. They have a big game against Liverpool in the League Cup final this weekend, and we could argue that Lukaku matching up against Van Dijk and or Matip or Gomez, whoever the other center back is, probably a little bit more favorable to have a big guy like Lukaku to occupy them with, as opposed to Havertz, who a little more frail than Lukaku, I would say. But it worked out. Havertz, I thought, was doing a good job of looking to combine, get in behind, just be a bit of a nuisance. Lille's marking on the corner kick was shambolic, I think is the word I'm going to use. Mm. The fact that they didn't mark him at all is probably a little bit disappointing for Lille, given that those types of plays have nothing to do with talent and just desire. But he also missed a sitter right before that. You know, and I actually think that spoke to his mentality, because maybe a Havertz of before under Tuchel when he first joined, you know, he missed that sitter and that would impact him the rest of the game. So for him to get a goal, you know, 5 minutes after missing the sitter, I think really speaks to his maturity and his continued evolution as a player. You know, I'm curious what Pulisic, I would love to get some insight from Pulisic about who he likes to play with. And is it Lukaku? Is it Havertz? I mean, who's his ideal striker of choice? But it's a tough one. I think that Lukaku will start this weekend. However, Havertz does have a knack of scoring goals in big finals for Chelsea, whether it's the Champions League or the FIFA Club World Cup game final. So that's a tough. I don't know. I don't know what Tuchel's going to elect to do, but I do feel like I'll be an apologist for Lukaku. It's not all his fault that he only had 7 touches this past weekend against Crystal Palace. The lineup that Chelsea put out there wasn't going to give him any service out wide, and Crystal Palace has sat on Jorginho and Conte and didn't let there be anything fluid through the middle, and he was just left out to dry, and there's only so much that guy can do by himself. So, you know, if they had the lineup they had today where they had proper wingbacks and Azpilicueta and Marcus Alonso, I don't think we'd be talking about Lukaku only getting 7 touches against Palace last week.
Yeah, JJ, you know, we just had a good question pop up from David about Thiago Silva. I mean, do you think he was a man of the match performance for this team? I mean, what do you think was the difference? Obviously, Lille didn't seem great, but what do you think made Chelsea sort of effective in the way that we've looked at Chelsea over at least last season, less so this year, but last season, the way that they just got the result by sort of grinding?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, typical efficiency, the kind of efficiency that I expect from Thomas Tuchel's sides. You know, I think they even wasted a great chance for the goal with the Havertz opportunity early on that you mentioned that he missed. For me, I wouldn't put it up there sort of with, you know, Thiago Silva's absolute best performances I've ever seen him put out there, but that's because I've seen so many of them. You know, he just, you know, Silva's level of consistency and performance for years now has just been so much higher than so many other players in that position. You know, he truly is an elite defender. You know, he's the kind of player that, you know, you show your kids if your kid decides they want to be a defender. Mm-hmm. You know, you're showing them the likes of Jimmy Conrad. You're showing them the likes of Jerry
Silva.
Obviously, you know, you're going to have like VHS tapes of Heath Pierce's greatest hits with Hansa Rostock as well. Honestly, Silva is just, he's a cut above, even though he's getting on. You know, he's just a step ahead of everyone mentally. You know, you can see him anticipating the stuff that's going to happen. Perhaps it helped that, you know, he and Tuchel, you know, they know what to expect from Lille, given that they were in competition with them up until a year or so ago. But, you know, I just think that it's not almost too easy, but, you know, Silva has been around the block so many times. He knows exactly sort of just how much he needs to put into these games, you know, to sort of stand out above the rest. And that's exactly what he did.
Jimmy, let me ask you this, because of the injury concerns with Ziyech and Kovacic. I mean, how much of that hangs in the balance for the potential success? Obviously, we continue to question what the best 11 from Chelsea is, and they've clearly got depth to sort of rotate constantly. But do you think this is a little bit of a concern, considering they've got a little bit of this cushion in the Champions League, but they've also got this very difficult schedule coming up, as you mentioned?
Well, I think what we've learned is that they play best in a certain formation when they have their three center backs and they have their two wing backs, even if it is Azpilicueta getting up and down the sideline. He might not have all the top ability that maybe or the youth as a Reece James might, but he does provide an understanding of how to move within the system. And I think the team just flows better when they play with four in the back, like they did against Crystal Palace. That's just the most recent example. They look stifled. They don't look as free flowing or fluid when they try to transition. I thought N'Golo Kanté was fantastic today. I thought he picked up the spots in good areas and drove the ball forward, which ultimately led to Pulisic's goal. And the more that they can do with that, I thought Lille was a little bit, maybe they were trying to get back in the game, but they definitely left some spaces open that I thought Chelsea did a very good job of exploiting. And when Chelsea are playing at that type of level and taking advantage of teams in transition, they are very, very good and hard to beat. But overall, with those two losses, I mean, Jorginho wasn't available for this one. So you had Saul. I forgot he actually played for Chelsea coming on Ruben. Loftus-Cheek comes on, but I think it actually spells good for, if I'm looking at it through the lenses of a U.S. men's national team fan, that Christian Pulisic will probably get another run out. And I just want to say, we haven't really talked about him yet. Fantastic goal. The first touch obviously is awesome, but the second touch is even better because it's a little soft touch to see what the goalkeeper is going to do and how he's going to charge out. And then he has a nice little third touch to lift it over him. When he plays in his best position and gets minutes, you can tell that he's got the trust of the manager, whether that's just because the manager didn't have any other options or whatever it is, you can see him rise to the occasion. So long may this form continue, because we're desperately going to need him here in the next qualifying window.
Yeah, I fully agree. And you could just see that comfort when he gets the ball and he starts to drive inside and he starts to shift a lot of those players to his left foot and starts to cut back inside. And when he does that best, there's very few players that I know of, American or not, that can do it at that level in combination play and changing the point of attack, driving in on his preferred foot. And obviously you can see there most UCL goals by US international Christian Pulisic, and he's still so young and has so far to go. It's funny, I'm not going to talk about Jordan Pefok at the bottom of that list because it's a soft subject for us right now. But JJ, let me ask you this. My final question on Chelsea in general is, based on the sample from today, the efficiency of their game, and again, an inferior opponent or the form of an inferior opponent in Lille, is the ceiling different with this Chelsea side, or do you still think they're going to run into the same issues like they have all year long? Or did you see something out of the ordinary from their performance today? Or was it more to the more closer to the lines of the fact they were just better than Lille?
No, I just think there was a significant gulf in class. I mean, I'm not ready to sort of write Chelsea off and say they're going to get to a certain point of the season but not go much further. You know, I don't sort of want to rule out a potential, you know, title defense just yet. I just don't think that they're quite as strong as some of the other challengers. You know, I think City, certainly in terms of the performances put in so far, you know, look like the team to beat. You know, obviously we've got Ajax to look forward to on Wednesday, and they've got 100% record. But, you know, this Chelsea side, I mean, I think there's still things that could derail them a little bit, because I'm looking at that defense when we were talking about it earlier. You know, we're still waiting for Christensen and Rudiger to sort out their futures. Silva is just one sort of muscle twinge, away from being a pretty big loss for them, given his influence. And Azpilicueta as well, not getting any younger, like you guys mentioned. So for me, I think that this Chelsea side, you know, they're going to go further. They're going to advance past Lille. I'm pretty confident in that. And I think they'll probably go another round or two more. But sort of based on tonight, I think I'm going to need to see them raise their game a couple more levels before I sort of take them really seriously as potential champion material.
Well, Jimmy, as you can see from the graphic up on the screen, teams haven't fared well. Obviously, we've got a little recency bias because you go before that to Real Madrid and there was, they fared quite well year after year. But in these last couple of years, teams kind of not being able to live up to the standard that they set the season before. Do you feel any differently about this Chelsea? Do they have enough tools to potentially make a run or grind out something? Or is they're just eventually going to come up against an opponent that's too good for them to continue?
I guess we have to wait to see what the draw looks like. I'll say, with reference to Bayern Munich last season, if Robert Lewandowski hadn't been hurt for those two legs against PSG, I think we'd be talking about a different Bayern run, potentially back to the final or at least close to it. Liverpool, yes, they didn't win the Champions League that year, but they went on to win the Premier League for the first time in 30 years. So maybe and the pandemic was hitting at the same time. So there was a lot to maybe focus on. So I don't know.
Are you making a bunch of excuses for that not being a real stat to me?
What I'm saying is I think that Chelsea do have all the players and ideas and philosophy and methodologies to get back to the final. I do think, to JJ's point, there's going to have to be a step up. We have seen some of their vulnerabilities in the league where they can't really keep it going consistently. They haven't actually been scoring a ton of goals. It's actually pleasantly surprised to see them score two tonight, even against the Lille team that was opened up a little bit. So I don't know. I think I want to see what the draw looks like, but Thomas Tuchel is so good in these competitions. He's so good at masterminding. And JJ's talked about this ad nauseum about how good he is in this, when he can just focus on one opponent, doesn't have to think about 10 months of opponents of a league, when he can just really get into the details. And I think he's so good at communicating to his team how to do that. And when you have the confidence of winning the competition before, you trust that manager in a way that maybe you wouldn't have if he hadn't won anything previous. So especially with this group of players, I can't count them out at this point. I'd still throw them in as one of the favorites to win it.
Well said, Jimmy. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to continue our Champions League conversations with Villarreal Juventus. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You hear that? Your dog knows spring is coming sooner than you think. Dog walks, dog parks, playing fetch, all the stuff your dog loves to do with you. But the warmer weather also means that fleas and ticks are coming back. Fleas and ticks are in the grass, in the woods, and even on their dog friends. Fleas are an itchy nuisance, can easily get into your home, furniture, and beds, which can be terrible. Ticks are even worse. They're hard to spot, but can carry disease and get your dog really sick. PetMeds has your furry friend protected with the best products to prevent flea and ticks all year long. PetMeds pharmacists connect directly with your vet to save you time and deliver the best products for your pet. PetMeds offers low prices on all flea and tick meds, including NexGard, Simparica, and more. And PetMeds AutoShip helps you save even more with additional discounts on regular shipments of PetMeds, dog food, and other high-quality supplies. So get ready for all the spring fun now. Visit PetMeds.com and use promo code PODCAST to save 40% on your first auto ship order. That's PetMeds.com and promo code PODCAST.
All right, everyone, we are back. Don't be shy. Get into the mix. Get some comments in. Producer Dez will throw the best ones up on the screen, or any ones that he feels are important or not important. Maybe it just throws them all up.
Or just the only ones.
Or the only ones. Yeah, we don't know. Jimmy's the only one that throws comments into the comment section while he's talking.
I've got so many burner accounts.
He's got three monitors, two keyboards, and all kinds of stuff going on over there, plus an entire team and a staff that works full time. So he's got people throwing in comments everywhere. In fact, I'm pretty sure he paid for that compliment that JJ gave, putting him and Thiago Silva into the same conversation. But let's talk about Villarreal Juventus. So Weston limps off. Couldn't put any weight on his left foot, Jimmy, in terms of the implications of that. Is it something we should be reading into? I mean, oddly, I saw Pulisic limping for a bit and I get real nervous because he tracked back that 50, 60 yard run and then was limping for a minute. I'm like, oh man, that he just pulled up with a hamstring chasing somebody down. But Weston McKennie actually looked like he took it, something's up.
What this is me highly speculative, my comments here, but I feel like when you get an ankle injury, when I watched the replay of the tackle from Estupiñán a couple times, it looks more like it catches him on the foot in some ways, like his foot tweaks as opposed to his ankle. And the only reason I say that, because when he's limping off, I broke my foot. And anytime I had an ankle injury, I'd always try to walk it off. Like, no, I can do it. I can do this. But when you break your foot, there's not a chance in goddamn hell you're going to put any weight on it whatsoever. Like, you're not even going to, you know that it's trouble. And that's what it looked like to me based on my experiences as a player, that when I had both of those injuries, I would always try to walk off an ankle injury, at least try to see how much weight I could put on it to at that particular moment go like, I feel 60%. I bet you it's only 2 weeks. You know, whatever stupid stuff you do as an athlete, when you try to have, you think you've got, you know, you're invincible. You come up with all these different little mind tricks to figure out where you are and how you stand and how healthy you think you're going to be in a minute's or a moment's notice. But I feel like when him limping off and not putting any weight on it is a major concern for me. Major concern.
JJ Vlahovic, first Champions League match, first goal. I mean, James Benj is not here, so this is a safe space. Do you agree that he's overrated? But do you agree with James that Vlahovic is overrated? I mean, what's your take on him so far? I mean, obviously, The Allegri's comments came out recently about him not knowing how to play two matches a week, and he's got a lot to learn, and you know, the different types of team, the like style of play, and all these types of things. I mean, do you think he's overrated, or are we seeing, you know, instant impact in a credible way?
No, I don't think that he's overrated. I just don't think that we've seen enough of him, given his age, to necessarily say whether he's you know, worthy of being sort of considered world class. I mean, he certainly looks like he's on his way to that bracket at this moment in time, given his form for Fiorentina. But you know, referencing what Allegri said, I mean, yeah, all of this is still completely new to him. I mean, what a way to introduce yourself to the Champions League, you know, scoring, you know, immediately after starting on your debut. Fantastic finish as well. You know, I think he just needs to, you know, be given a bit of time, you know, sort of, I don't know, maybe have his first full season in the competition, you know, really get to know what it's like at the top level, you know, with all due respect to Fiorentina, a club that I have a lot of fondness for. You know, because that's exactly what he's going to be getting at the institution that is Juventus. You know, he's going to be expected to challenge for Serie A titles, Coppa Italia titles, you know, to make a real impact in the Champions League as well. And, you know, he's started as he means to go on. So I'm not quite ready to throw out there yet that he is world class, but he, you know, he's definitely one of the most informed attacking players on the continent at this moment in time, if not the most. I just think it's maybe a bit early to judge and say, yeah, he's world class, or no, he's trash, he's overrated.
JJ's drinking that anti-Vlahovic Kool-Aid that he's sharing with James Benj right now.
Yeah,
that was a world class goal. I mean, the fact that recognition that early. I know it's just a goal and it's just one play.
But it's a quick release and it's a strike when you're off balance. Okay. The keeper hasn't set his feet. You don't expect somebody to shoot from there.
Yeah, recognition, awareness. I think he purposely tried to hit it on the other side of the defender because I thought there was a little bit of a brief pause to wait to see where the defender was setting Albiol there. Because when I looked at Albiol's defending there, the captain of Villarreal, I thought, all right, I don't think I would have done much different there. Sometimes you just got a hat tip the goal scorer and be like, all right, that was a pretty good play. Now, can Vlahovic do more over those 90 minutes? Can he be even more influential? I think that's ultimately, and JJ, I'm just giving you a hard time, of what I don't feel like he put as much of a stance. Like, he did his job. He scored in the first minute of his first ever game in a Champions League. And not that he relaxed. He's always still going to give you that effort. But was it the Was he as efficient as he could be with his effort? Was it enough to bring more of his team into the game? Could they have held on to that lead based on something that he did by holding up the ball? These little nuances and subtleties that I think will only come from experience, of course, as JJ says, but also playing in the system under Maxi Allegri. I do feel like they missed the ball a little bit in this particular game. Just that one link-up player that is so good between the lines that could release Vlahovic to stay a little bit higher up the field. So, I mean, what a goal, though. I just didn't want to take anything away from that goal and then just that awareness so early on in the game. And here's a fun fact. He scored in 36 seconds. And I was like, I wonder what the fastest goal in Champions League history is. Do you guys remember what it was? Any guesses?
7 seconds.
No. JJ?
I'm going to go for something less than 20. 18.
10 seconds. Roy Mackay. Roberto Carlos made a mistake. 2007. Ball
Roy
gets played
Mackay.
In.
Wow.
Roy Mackay, who looks kind of like Luis Suarez, which is kind of weird. But he scores 10 seconds in Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid in 2007. 10 seconds. That's crazy. And there was three other goals that were 20 seconds. So Dusan Vlahovic at 36 seconds is the fifth fastest goal in Champions League history.
Wow, Roy Mackay. I just didn't expect anybody to say Roy Mackay for the rest of my life. But wow, what a player he was, by the way. JJ, the spine of this team different, right? Obviously, we want Weston McKennie in there, but now he seems to be sort of a little bit more of an attacking threat and deployed closer to the wing than up the spine of the team there with Delict, Locatelli, and Vlahovic. Did you like what you saw in this match? I mean, obviously, they gave up the draw in this one playing away from home, which I think fares well for them. But when you think about Juventus and the form that they've been in, you do sort of expect them to be able to, at least if they get a lead, keep that lead against a Villarreal side.
Disclaimer before I go on to chat about this, I was obliged to spend more time watching Chelsea Lille than this game. But the one thing that I will say, having kept an eye on it, is I feel like history is repeating itself with Adrien Rabiot. I feel like he's a big question mark in this Juve team, and he's in such an important position that I don't really think, James Benge actually, funnily enough, I think dropped into Slack earlier a very good description of him, that he's so often a passenger in these games. I mean, I know that there's big controversy that we'll probably get on to discuss regarding Rabiot in a couple of minutes, but sort of in terms of what he actually like brings to the party, you know, I'm sort of asking myself now, it's been a couple of years since he's moved out there, and he hasn't kicked on the way that I expected him to and the way that I'm sure he would have done at PSG if he'd agreed to play in the position that he was being asked to play in, which is more of a holding role in the midfield. It feels very frustrating. I'm not trying to single him out because there's a couple of other guys within the Juve squad who I feel can, you know, maybe do better at times. But Rabiot is one who particularly frustrates me because I know how brilliant he can be on his day. It's just that, you know, those days are sort of 2 out of 10 matches.
That's well said. Jimmy, Weston McKennie, do you like him when he's closer to the wing? Is he a straight up central midfielder for you? Is he an eight? Is he an 8.5, kind of higher up the field? I mean, it seems like he has tools in every one of these types of positions, but sometimes you run the risk of not actually knowing what you're best at, right? Are you a two-way midfielder? Are you an all-out attacking type of player? Could that be deployed in the national team? And what's your take on this before we see you out?
Yeah, I got to go do some CBS Sports HQ, everybody. But my final thoughts here for the pod, and I appreciate you guys having me on, about Weston McKennie. I like him kind of at an 8.5, to be honest. I like him higher up the field because he does have this commitment to take risk. Now, some coaches might not like that, and maybe even Maxi Allegri at times is like, oh, Weston, don't go forward. You're going to leave us a little bit vulnerable in midfield or whatever it is. But I think he's getting better at making those choices as to when to join the attack and maybe when to sit in and around and just be more of a support player to create an angle to maybe connect those passes. He's only going to get better at that. But the fact that he has that in him, in his DNA, he likes to attack. He likes to take those risks. He likes to bomb forward. And as you know, and I think everybody can speak to it, if you're a center back and you're marking a striker, and then all of a sudden, this midfielder comes out of nowhere. It's hard for a CDM to track that runner in. So all of a sudden, you got to try to mark two players. And McKennie's very good at getting on the end of those types of crosses. And so as his decision-making continues to mature and evolve, he's only going to become more and more valuable to Juve or any other team that he plays for, including the U.S. men's national team. But I like him a little bit more central. I think it gives him more opportunities if he starts centrally to pick his spots as to when he wants to maybe go out into a wider channel to go get it, if you can see that's where the space is. Or if he wants to join the attack, he's a little bit closer to making that happen. But yeah, the future's bright for Weston McKennie. I'm super bummed that he got hurt. And I wish we would have got to see him finish out this game and obviously play in leg two, but I don't know.
Who do you got in leg two, Jimmy? And then you can just click that button just to disappear on us.
No, I think Juve at home, it's going to be hard to beat. I think Maxi Allegri is going to have it going. I do want to give a shout out to Villarreal, though. Unai Emery, obviously, this isn't the Europa League where he's a master, but it's still a knockout competition, and you can't sleep on them, especially if they get Gerard Moreno back, because I thought that they really missed Gerard Moreno today. They were in and around the box a lot, but kind of missed that clinical finisher in and around the box. But super organized team, obviously tough to break down. So I could see it going to a draw again, and then maybe an extra time. That's where Juve ends up winning it. But if Villarreal somehow scraped through and got the points and got the victory, I wouldn't be surprised either. But because there's a couple weeks between leg two and leg one, then it's possible that everybody can get healthy, and we'll see where it goes from there. So that's me straddling the fence. Thanks for having me, everybody. It's always been a pleasure. Peace out, later.
All right, producer Dez, let's get that graphic back up on the screen. I think that's an important one. Take a look at that here. And obviously you can see these group stage results. He talked about Unai Emery, JJ. I mean, obviously it's not the Europa League where he is the specialist, but they weren't fantastic in the group stages, but it was a difficult group for a team like Villarreal, and they were able to get out on the final day versus Atalanta. Do you think this is too far for them to overcome against this Juventus side in the second leg playing away from home, or do you think there's a legitimate chance? Because obviously, on paper, they're very much in this, and it wasn't like they were played off the pitch for long periods. They actually looked quite good, and like Jimmy said, they were just missing a little bit around the box. That changes when you're away from home, and the tactics do as well. But a 1-1 draw at home certainly feels like some result if you're Unai Emery.
Yeah, I don't think it's a disastrous result at all. I mean, especially now that we're not talking about away goals, you know, and I think when you look at the quality that Villarreal have, especially if they can get Moreno back for some stretch at some point in the season, you know, that makes a huge difference. My big worry for Villarreal is not necessarily whether they can get past Juve in the second leg. I think in any given game, they can definitely, you know, frustrate their opponent and potentially even, you know, beat them, snatch the victory. I worry about the situation they find themselves in La Liga, where they're looking upwards towards the European positions, trying to catch up, you know, with that chasing pack at the top of the table, and, you know, trying to keep pushing ahead in the Champions League as well. It's almost like it's going to be one or the other. And I feel that if they do manage to get past Juve, then perhaps their La Liga form will suffer. And if they go out, then at least they can fully concentrate on La Liga. You know, they started the season pretty slowly. And, you know, they added an important piece in Dan Juma quite late in the transfer window as well. I get the feeling that they're a team who are going to be a bigger threat next season. But obviously, we don't know where they're going to finish in La Liga at the moment or how this Champions League campaign is going to pan out. So it's up to them. They're the masters of their own destiny. In an exclusive that Luis Miguel Echegaray had with Dan Juma a couple of weeks ago, he was basically saying, you know, it's up to them, you know, whether or not they finish in the top four. They definitely have it within them, within that group. It's just, you know, up to them to make the best of it. I think that they can, you know, spring a bit of a surprise and knock Juve out, but also at the same time, you know, this Juve side has come a long way, you know, in the last couple of months, because at the beginning of the season they were pretty horrible to watch. You know, there's more of a structure now that Allegri has got into place. His feet are firmly back under the table since returning. You know, so this one's going to be a really fascinating second leg. Could go either way. And honestly, it wouldn't surprise me with either side going through, but I just feel like for Villarreal, it's not maybe the best moment for them to be trying to juggle, you know, both domestic and continental competitions.
Well, the upside for them is that in the last five, they're unbeaten, right? I think they have one loss in their last seven, and that included draw against Atletico Madrid. That included a draw against Real Madrid. That included a win against Real Betis, and now another draw against Juventus. So they're certainly in matches in ways that, you know, like you said, the slow start to the season, the fact that they're not in a European position and they're trending in that right direction, be easy to sort of cave in now, but it seems like they're sort of picking up a little bit of a steam or a belief system and their ability to get out and hopefully finish the season in a European spot.
But that's also what Emery teams do in the Europa League. So if they can sort of extrapolate that into the Champions League, you know, who knows? Maybe it lands them a quarterfinal berth.
That's well said. Let's move on to the UEFA and the fact that you know, there's considerations now being made about where this match in St. Petersburg might be played. Are you hearing anything, I guess, from your side? Is there anything legitimate? And if so, if there was a move, have they predetermined? I know that there are usually predetermined plan B, plan Cs out there, but is there, what are you hearing on your end?
Yeah, where's Jimmy when you need him to weigh in first on the controversial issue? from what I've read so far, obviously this is a very sensitive topic at the moment, not just in a football sense, but in the wider global political sense as well. I can't see how it wouldn't be a consideration, given the escalation of tension over the last couple of weeks. The reports in France certainly suggest that discussions are already underway to potentially move it somewhere. I've seen Wembley, bandied about as a potential destination for any potentially rearranged final. I guess, the sort of precedent that we can point to with regards to this kind of stuff is the fact that UEFA have had to try to be flexible due to COVID the last couple of years. So we have, seen matches moved, venues changed, there is a possibility of that happening. But, it seems like the things are changing all the time, given all the different declarations, the rising tension. Schalke, who are very strongly sponsored by Gazprom, have basically said they're keeping a very close eye on everything that's going on, and obviously hoping that there can be some sort of peaceful resolution. So I think everybody is hoping that there is some sort of step down in the recent escalation. But in terms of whether it's likely to see a final in St. Petersburg at this moment in time, it's difficult to say yes, because it just seems like a very untenable situation every time you turn the news on.
Yeah. I don't have much more to say to that. I usually, like you said, we let Jimmy jump into those waters before we just follow up with our take of sitting on the fence. But Des, let's talk about let's quickly touch on tomorrow's matches. We'll throw up a graphic of what we have for tomorrow. Atletico Madrid, Man United, Benfica against Ajax. Obviously, all of those 3 p.m. Eastern time on CBS and Paramount Plus. Make sure you tune into those. JJ, I mean, are any one of these two matches more exciting to you? And if so, why?
Infinitely. I'm really, really excited to watch Benfica Ajax, and Atletico Madrid United is probably up there among the worst draws that I could possibly imagine. So I'm looking forward to covering Benfica Ajax in the match updates tomorrow. It's for me, I think it's a really fascinating battle. Ajax, as I mentioned earlier, one of the informed teams in the Champions League so far, 100% winning record. Benfica, really, really interesting sort of makeup to their squad. Got some very, very talented players. Both teams have very prolific attackers in Haller and Nunez, but they also have gifted creators as well. You've got Rafa Silva for Benfica. You've got Dusan Tadic for Ajax. So I think that's going to be really fascinating to see how that one plays out. And I can't wait for it. And with United Atleti, I felt so underwhelmed by both of these teams at various points this season when we've been discussing them. I know that Atleti have picked up slightly more of late, but United, it just feels like Groundhog Day all the time. Every time I come on and we're discussing United, whether it was under Solskjaer, whether it's under Randick now, it just feels like the situation never really changes. So, I hope that I'm proved wrong and it turns into an absolute classic. But, really looking at it on paper, I'm not expecting fireworks in that one.
It seems to me that Ajax, especially, being the unbeaten team in Champions League in such great form, it's just such a long window to not see them. And obviously, I watch some games in the Eredivisie, but I'm going through their results right now. And you talk about some of their like weaponry that they have in the attack. And I mean, it's 5-0, 3-0, 4-0.
9-0 in the cup as well.
9-0 in the cup. The round before that, they won 5-0 in the cup. And so it's a lot of a dominant attack performances, which you expect from Ajax traditionally. Do you think that form still holds up now in the knockout rounds? They're playing against a completely different type of opponent. They haven't faced an opponent of this level in probably a couple months. Yes, they played PSV a month or so ago and were able to win and have a little bit gap at the top of the table now. But do you think that it's difficult to prepare going back into the Champions League after a break like this?
I mean, I think, you have to look at that PSV performance and say that's probably, you know, the most like a European game for them in terms of quality, with all due respect to the teams that they've come up against. It's, you know, a very impressive 10 consecutive matches winning run that they're on at the moment. But, I kind of feel like this is kind of how people see like teams like PSG, coming and Bayern coming into their Champions League games. Like, they're just absolutely romping against all of their domestic opponents when it's not necessarily the case. But for Ajax, I feel that, you know, at this moment in time, they're just utterly dominant, and they're so dominant because they've moved away ever so slightly from this policy that we've always associated with Ajax of having young players. Because with the addition of some slightly more experienced guys, the likes of Tadic, you know, Daley Blind coming back, Haller, who's sort of in his mid-20s and not quite in the early 20s bracket that you'd expect from Ajax players, with that bit of experience, Taliafico as well, suddenly they have a lot more experience. They're able to sort of regulate these performances. And okay, you know, perhaps, that counts for more in terms of the goals and the sizes of the victories they're getting in the Eredivisie. But I don't think that they'll look out to their depth, once they get back into Champions League action. I don't think it's, going to come as too much of a shock to the system. And perhaps this is where the draw plays into their favour as well, because, yeah, they're coming up against a Benfica side with a lot of talented players, no doubt. But also, this is a Benfica side that, yes, they beat Barca at home and drew away. But also, you know, they did still get a bunch of goals stuck past them by Bayern Munich. So they're definitely a beatable opponent. And I think playing away first for Ajax is a good thing, because it'll challenge them to raise their game. And then obviously at home, we've seen in the last couple of years that anything is possible for Ajax when they're playing at Amsterdam Arena in Europe. And it's I just feel that right now this Ajax side are kind of primed to deliver. And I actually wonder if this might be the last season for some of them to be performing at such a high level, especially when you're looking at somebody like Tadic, who's in his 30s, and you just wonder how long he can keep up this fantastic form that he's in.
Well, it's like you said, when you shift away from sort of the traditional teenagers into early 20s and you have the selling model, it takes the pressure off when you get into certain rounds, because it's a nice to have, but it's not the mandatory thing. The player development is the main thing. But when you start to take chances, have a record-breaking transfer and Haller, and you have the run that they're on, it can only last so long before that rotation has to continue. And that's the hard part of building sort of that hybrid model between player development and then trying to, domestically win trophies, but try to do something in Europe is certainly different. But any closing thoughts for you, JJ, before we close this thing out?
We're just here doing the, sort of our hot take just after the action. Unfortunately, it sounds like The early feedback regarding Weston McKennie is not good. Obviously, we had a similar scare with Borussia Dortmund and Gio Reyna. Just fingers crossed that it's not as serious as perhaps people are making out. But it is obviously really worrying. Worrying for us as lovers of great soccer in the Champions League, but especially worrying for you guys with the US men's national team as well. So fingers crossed, it's not quite as bad as it initially sounds, but it is a worry.
Yeah, as Jimmy mentioned, that sort of lack of ability to put your foot weight on your foot is concerning. And now with reports coming out that perhaps it's a fracture, certainly not what we want to hear as U.S. men's national team fans, or any fans in general, don't want to see anybody getting hurt. But that is it for us. Thank you all for watching and or listening. Follow K Golasso Podcast on Twitter @ K Golasso Pod. Subscribe to the K Golasso page on YouTube and hit the notification bell. And of course, subscribe to K Golasso wherever you get your podcasts. And from myself, our producer, Des Norris, JJ, and of course, Jimmy Conrad, who joined us earlier, thank you guys so much, and we will see you all soon.
CBS Monday.
NCIS! Here's where we can see them.
NCIS and NCIS Hawaii return with all new cases.
Double tap to the chest, one to the head.
These guys are professionals.
All new criminals.
Violent island to got here.
Welcome to paradise.
And all new crimes to be solved.
If you're watching this, I've been arrested.
What are the charges?
Just one. Murder.
New NCIS and NCIS Hawaii, Monday starting at 9/8 Central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.